of income. Borrowing to consume, not inadequate savings, was at the heart of current account deterioration. Private financial borrowing manifestly cannot be borrowing in the full faith and credit sense, involving the backing of the U.S. government. Still, the lesson of the last quarter of a century is that private excesses, from savings and loans to hedge funds, have been bailed out by federal agencies and appointees for public policy reasons. The private risk of high finance has been socialized, according to James Grant and other debt observers, even if the profits have not. Chairman Greenspan, as already noted, took policy responsibility in 2002 and again in 2004 for declining to prevent the buildup of credit or asset bubbles. Better, he said, to deal later with their subsequent ramifications by providing liquidity. Other central banks, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Reserve Bank of Australia, the Bank for International Settlements, have contended that the greater harm may come from lack of prevention. For political calculations, can the Federal Reserve Board be presumed to have put the government behind its subsequent liquidity waves? Theory this may be, but it is not remote. The management of private debt in the United States has a closer relationship than elsewhere to politics and government, and in the wake of the events of September 11th, it became a thinly disguised instrument of public policy, stimulating consumer demand. This implies government obligations. This brings us to mortgage debt, much of which is held by banks and other institutions in the financial services cohort. Given the Federal Reserve's central role in allowing mortgage debt to mushroom from $4.4 billion in 2000 to $7.5 trillion in 2004, maintenance of the upward reevaluation of homes may be the next frontier of risk socialization. Direct and repackaged consumer debt also bulks large, and in some very speculative forms, in the asset portfolios of the contemporary economy. The entirety of the U.S. credit bubble, then, public and private alike, must be considered in judging the dangers of debt and the applicability of historic precedents. Unfortunately, the useful precedents are few, the hazards many. The indentured American household? Concern about Americans becoming indentured servants or sharecroppers laboring on behalf of whip-holding creditors, credit card companies in the United States, dollar-holding central bankers in Asia, became a marginal political issue in 2005, struggling for attention but not getting much. The analogy did not strike a popular chord. Indentured servitude had been allowed in the 13 colonies of 1775 under British law, and it was not forbidden after the Revolution by the new American Republic. The practice had been reinforced by imprisonment, re-indenturing, and other penalties. Nevertheless, by 1800, it had largely withered. In the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, indenturing became unacceptable, at least for whites. 200 years later, personal bankruptcy filings under Chapters 7 and 13 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code during the first Bush administration totaled close to 5 million, a record for a single White House term. Household pressures were becoming acute. In 2005, Congress passed and the President signed new federal bankruptcy legislation promoted by a worried credit card industry. It required would-be bankrupts with incomes above a certain level to accept a new status under Chapter 13. Instead of having their debts discharged, they would keep paying determined credit card charges, medical bills, and other obligations. Proponents made the valid point that many filers shouldn't be allowed to use the permissive Chapter 7 procedures to simply walk away from their debts. Opponents countered that the new procedures were extreme and could lend themselves to harsh implementation. Some of the angriest foes, including House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi and Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, likened the future status of bankrupts to modern-day indentured servants. Few in the media took the interpretive bait. The analogy is premature until we see how bankruptcy procedures under the 2005 Act play out over a number of years. However, the debilitation of wage earners is clear enough. Over the last 4 decades, as manufacturing employment has tumbled and finance has gained, wages have declined sharply as a share of personal income. Borrowing and spending as a percentage of wages, in turn, have both soared. For not quite half of the population, what some Democrats would picture as involuntary servitude can be summed up thus. The number of good jobs shrinks, wages decline, consumer appetites remain constant or intensify, credit cards are pitched endlessly and misleadingly, the credulous sign up and cards are issued. Rates and charges eventually change, pain begins, and on go the plastic shackles. Because of the unusual harness yoking the American consumer to the world economy, a vague public sense of being used, dry political tinder of the first order, could develop. We have seen that the 1990s credit card takeoff had several stages. It began, said Robert Manning, author of Credit Card Nation, in 1997 when credit card issuers targeted young people and pursued them relentlessly. Consumer historian Peter Stearns described the national mindset before September 11th. For many people, particularly in the United States, the commitment to consumerism introduced a new precariousness to material life. By 2001, despite unprecedentedly high incomes, over half of all Americans had almost no savings, and a third lived paycheck to paycheck, often in considerable consumer debt. In some cases, this situation reflected continued real poverty, but in others it followed from a sense that so many goods and trips had become absolutely essential. A new stage came after September 11th, when spending as patriotism combined with economic apprehension and the lowest interest rates in 40 years to promote home refinancing and debt consolidation. Both usually provided spendable cash or mortgage payment savings and stimulated a weak economy. The downside was that between the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004, household debt grew by 39%. Real disposable income, however, showed very little growth. In 2005, macroeconomist Stephanie Pomboy explained that over the three previous years, consumers had leaned more heavily on new borrowing, $675 billion of non-mortgage debt, than on paychecks, up only $530 billion, to make possible the overall $1.3 trillion increase in their spending. The period after September 11th also saw a stepped-up Washington bias in favor of the credit card industry, especially on the part of the Bush administration. For credit card firms, the ability to borrow at 1-2% facilitated their ability to offer new cardholders sweet enrollment deals and often the chance to consolidate their debt in one place at seemingly great savings. However, once the new enrollee was hooked, the card companies were free to raise rates on just about any pretext, often from 6 or 11% into the 20-30% range, and to take advantage of the deregulation of fees authorized by the 1996 Smiley decision. Little or no attempt was made by the White House to rein in the card issuers with an appeal to wartime patriotism, unlike that made to consumers to spend patriotically and shared sacrifice. On the contrary, profiteering flourished. To call the fees lucrative is an understatement. Between 2000 and 2004, lateness and over-the-borrowing limit penalties ballooned, and overall credit card profits soared. According to CBS News, the portion of credit card issuer profits represented by fees jumped from 28% in 2000 to 33% in 2002, 35% in 2003, and an estimated 39% in 2004. The hidden costs of credit to consumers rode an up escalator even as the actual borrowing costs of the corporate issuers declined. By late 2004, the main wave of card use for debt consolidation and consumption had crested, but only after reshaping the U.S. credit landscape. Between 1990 and 2003, the number of people holding credit cards jumped by 75%, from 82 million to 144 million, but the amount actually charged exploded by 350%, up from $338 billion to $1.5 trillion. By 2004, public attention was recentering on real estate, the prime lever of the Federal Reserve strategy for rebuilding the assets base of middle, upper-middle, and upper-bracket Americans. Between 2000 and 2004, as we have seen, mortgage debt in the United States rose from $4.4 trillion to $7.5 trillion. Surging home values shared the limelight with bargain refinancing. The caveat was that although mortgage debt in the United States increased 66% between 2000 and 2004, Americans heeding the government's call to refinance at low rates usually spent the proceeds on consumer goods, not savings or home improvements. Thus, although the value of household real estate climbed 40% between the end of 2000 and the middle of 2004, collectively owners wound up having lower percentages of equity in their own homes. Adding to the uncertain prospects for stability, an increasing percentage of homeowners chose to take out interest-only loans or adjustable-rate mortgage variations, contracts that essentially bet on several more years of fast-rising prices. In states such as California, where interest-only loans represented some 60% of all those taken out in 2005, one-third of homebuyers admitted to making an investment rather than selecting a long-term residence. Even in the United States as a whole, 23% of home sales were to investors. Alan Greenspan, who had promoted the refinancing mentality, expressed concern in late spring 2005 about the dramatic increase in the prevalence of interest-only loans, as well as the introduction of other relatively exotic forms of adjustable-rate mortgages. Indeed, these came in literally hundreds of packages and flavors. He added that the apparent froth in housing markets may have spilled over into mortgage markets, a reference to loose lending practices. The Federal Reserve Chairman's apprehensions prompted reassurances from mortgage bankers that the secondary market in mortgages assured wide dispersal of risk. But those concerned by the bubble were not convinced, and the Washington Post noted another worry. Many of the frothiest housing markets were in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Boston, New York City, and Washington, cities that were also major financial centers. One kind of speculation was helping to breed another. Total household debt, which includes both consumer debt and mortgage debt, jumped from $6.5 trillion in 2000 to $10.2 trillion in 2004. This leap reflected the government's emphasis on stimulating private debt, and the sum exceeded most national debt calculations. Precious few economists spoke of the actual national debt as anything resembling a bubble. The possible home price bubble, by contrast, preoccupied cocktail conversation from Long Island to San Diego. Although the stock market crash between 2000 and 2002 had been contained, international historical research, as we have seen, suggested that a housing debacle involving even half the 2000 to 2002 wealth decline in stocks could produce a greater fallout in the overall economy. 40% of the new jobs created in the private sector between 2001 and 2005 were housing-related. In ordinary times, the idea of bankrupt Americans becoming indentured to credit card operators could be taken as overwrought political propaganda. However, the fallout from a 10 to 20% national housing price slump could make the analogy somewhat more credible. Bankruptcies or shattered credit might well put millions of cardholders in thrall to dozens of issuers and mortgage lenders. And if household America slowed its consumption, thereby ceasing to play locomotive to the world, the domestic and global effects could be incendiary. Finance, the invisible foot? More even than the future of Britain in 1914, the economic trajectory of the United States was in the hands of the financial sector. Chapter 9 developed some of the historical reasons for concern, despite the talk of a new economic paradigm. Finance by itself has never been enough to sustain a leading world economic power. Multi-billionaire investor Warren Buffett, known for his dismissal of finance as a den of vanity and profiteering, occasionally extended his mockery to Adam Smith's famous invisible hand and its supposed role in guiding markets to optimal outcomes, as we have seen. To Buffett, finance was no such boon. He first said as much in his 1983 annual message to Berkshire Hathaway shareholders. Hyperactive equity markets subvert rational capital allocation and act as pie shrinkers. Adam Smith felt that all non-collusive acts in a free market were guided by an invisible hand that led an economy to maximum progress. Our view is that casino-type markets and hair-trigger investment management act as an invisible foot that trips up and slows down a forward-moving economy. Since then, although the Nebraskan's own fortune swelled to become the nation's second biggest, his comments on the financial sector remained disdainful. Derivatives were financial weapons of mass destruction, and credit default swaps were a time bomb. On top of this, he said that huge trade deficits threatened to turn the United States into a sharecropper society, a mockery of White House talk about an ownership society. In a 2005 letter to his shareholders, Buffett grumbled that, in effect, the rest of the world enjoys an ever-growing royalty on the American output. Here we are like a family that consistently overspends its income. As time passes, the family finds that it is working more and more for the finance company and less for itself. For Buffett, the invisible foot was kicking even harder. Whether Smith or Buffett had the better analogy may depend on the outcome of a second new private debt expansion, undertaken by the financial sector, that exceeded even the credit card and mortgage escalation of household indebtedness. Between 1995 and 2004, financial sector domestic debt soared from $4.33 trillion to $11.79 trillion. In 1980, financial sector debt had been a mere $700 billion. This gargantuan increase explained much more than just the fin de siècle stock boom and bust. A rare convergence was at work, with a newly deregulated and ambitious financial sector taking advantage of the deregulation in 1996 of two other industries, merchant energy and telecommunications. The three-sector collusion created some $4 trillion in new bond and loan debt in the second half of the 1990s, the issuance of which peaked between 1998 and 2000 alongside the stock market indexes. Together with a seemingly endless parade of financial mergers and buccaneering hedge funds, and the deployment of a new array of speculative and derivative instruments and strategies, the result was what amounted to a grand financial sector takeover of the economy. In the fall of 1996, Foreign Policy published an article by John C. Edmonds, an academic economist, grandly entitled Securities, the New Wealth Machine. Under the banner of securitization, the bundling of related or eclectic loans into asset-backed securities, ABSs, the author hypothesized a new age in which a nation could increase its wealth by enlarging, through innovative structuring, the market valuation of its production assets. Producing more goods and services wasn't actually necessary. While the jury is still out on the new age, ABSs were clearly an idea whose profitability had come. And they had a lot of company. The torrent of new debt-related instruments and borrowing was central in lifting the relative weight of financial services from some 15% of GDP in 1980 to 20% in 2000, thereby staking out a clear predominance for the sector in stock market capitalization after the NASDAQ debacle. The most important new instruments, far more complex structurally than the asset-backed securities of the early 1990s, were the categories of credit default swaps, CDSs, and collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, both sold by banks over-the-counter rather than traded through exchanges. The first allowed investors to insure the credit risk of their bond and loan holdings. The second represented purchasable pools of corporate credit, divided into three or more layers to reflect varying degrees of risk. Despite the complexity of CDOs, which required extensive documentation by their bank issuers, credit derivatives became so popular that their global market expanded from embryonic status in 1997 to greater than $1 trillion in 2001, well over $3 trillion in 2003, and projected $8 trillion in 2006. Pricing these instruments is subjective, and they are illiquid to boot, making the potential cost of any debacle that requires their panic sale chilling. Similarly, while the combined derivatives markets grew to a nominal value of $270 trillion in 2004, no one knew what they would really be worth in a panic. This immensity of early 21st century finance dwarfs the comparative expansion of railroad mileage, debt, and power in the 1850s and 1860s. Still, there is an unfortunate parallel to railroading's domination of federal, state, and local politics, as well as to its ability to long fend off most attempts at regulation. Financial services enjoyed a kindred position in the 1980s and 1990s. As innovation, computerization, and broad deregulation opened up grand vistas, politicians whose eyes saw contributor dollar signs at the very mention of names such as Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and Goldman Sachs kept day-to-day regulators saluting respectfully. The Federal Reserve, long the principal shepherd of the banking sector, became financial services' most important advocate. The board's anxiousness to see American financial services giants emerge to challenge Japanese and European behemoths such as Mitsubishi, Credit Suisse, and Deutsche Bank expressed itself in thinly disguised collaboration. Potential stock market constraints like higher margin requirements were left unused. Putative financial collapses were transformed into expensive rescues. Assets losing air were reinflated, and bubbles were rarely and belatedly noticed, and never, ever pricked. Even the railroads had not done so well. From 2001 to 2004, and especially after September 11th, the Federal Reserve managed an economic architectural triumph on the scale of the Great Pyramids at Luxor. The financial and real estate base of American wealth was rebuilt, shifting primacy from stocks back to home values. In many ways, the rescue was extraordinary. The downside, obviously, lies in the debt used to bring it about. Perhaps we can now take a better inventory. The national debt, having been expanded to pay for stimulus, must make the list. So, too, consumer borrowing and mortgage debt. The expansion of corporate debt, part of it refinancing at the lowest rates in nearly half a century, helped to rebuild stock market capitalization. As for the incredible expansion of financial sector debt, some of it doubtless strengthened Adam Smith's invisible hand, and a considerable amount propelled Warren Buffett's invisible foot. The point is that easy private credit became public policy, and to a unique degree. However, with so much new debt created, the stimulus per dollar showed a significant decline. Although economists used different yardsticks and ratios, the message was essentially the same. From 1988 to 2000, the ratio of non-financial debt to GDP had stayed at 1.8 to 1. But then from 2001 to 2003, the ratio widened. $4.2 trillion more in debt turned out to add only $1.3 trillion in new GDP. In 2005, another economist acknowledged diminishing marginal returns on credit, in that it takes more and more debt now to fuel each marginal dollar of consumption. It now takes 11 cents of new debt to generate each additional dollar of consumption. That's up from just 3 cents in 1992. The burdens on consumers, meanwhile, became heavier. In the first quarter of 2005, households paid out 10.35% of their income to service mortgages, the highest since 1991. At 13.4%, the overall consumer and mortgage household debt service ratio, debt payments to disposable income, was at an all-time high. The broader ratio of household outlays for all financial obligations, adding rent, auto lease payments, homeowners insurance, and property taxes, was 18.4%, just under the 2001 to 2003 peak. With respect to automobile loans, some 40% of those buying new cars with the zero financing of 2003 to 2004 were trading in vehicles on which they owed more than the auto was then worth. The other emerging predicament was global. The massive current account deficit, which reflected a United States living beyond its means, and the uncertain duration of the unusual willingness of Asian central banks to fund it by buying and holding its federal debt. And now, over to Asia. To Abraham Lincoln, war was too important to be left to generals, and other presidents have had more or less the same concern about the state of the economy. It is too important to be left to economists. For example, accurate and dramatic discussion of the ballooning U.S. current account deficit, the broadest measurement of how much more Americans buy or pay out overseas than they sell or bring back, has been impeded by sterile economic parlance. Academic experts have tended to link current account deficits to federal budget deficits or to an inadequacy of national savings. Explanations that have failed to motivate citizens and non-economist decision-makers, especially elected ones. A more engaging explanation might go something like this. Yes, Americans have saved too little because they consume too much. Still, there are several reasons for having consumed a steadily higher amount relative to wages. On one hand, wages aren't the same share of national income that they used to be, and over this same period, Americans, young people especially, have been increasingly fixated on consumption. As for why so much of the consumption has involved imports, in 2004 the United States imported goods worth 54% more than those it exported, two practical explanations stand out. First, the United States competitively makes fewer and fewer manufactured goods. Second, data confirm that the 50 states produce less than half of the oil consumed here. Unelaborated jargon about savings fuddles much of the serious politics involved. The increasing U.S. dependence on manufactured and petroleum imports from East Asia and the Middle East. Asians and continental Europeans, who tend to take a more nationalistic view of trade, cannot understand how Americans can sit around with so little concern over their red, ink-stained current accounts ledgers. The British are also amazed. Neil Ferguson, a Harvard historian well-versed in economics, makes the perfectly valid point that although Britain, circa 1910, saw her manufactured exports weaken, they remained substantial. And so did fiscal conservatism in Downing Street. Thus, whereas Britain in her prime remained a lopsided creditor nation, the United States since the late 1980s has used its global sway to pursue a borrowing mode. Alas, the United States is the first leading economic power to take this path since Spain. A quarter century of public and private American affinity for debt, the term overconsumption loses the fiscal half of the message, has helped erect the largest national current account deficit the world has ever seen. Both political parties have abetted this, but the Republicans more so. In a 2004 speech to a meeting of international economists, former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers candidly described the fiscal elephant in the American parlor. The U.S. current account deficit is currently running well in excess of $600 billion at an annual rate, in the range of 5.5% of GDP. It represents well over 1% of global GDP and absorbs close to two-thirds of the cumulative current account surpluses of all the world's surplus countries. All of these figures are without precedent. The United States has never run such large current account deficits, and no single nation's deficit has ever bulked nearly as large relative to the global economy. There is a 1990 to 2004 relationship between rise in U.S. consumption as a share of GDP and the surge in the nation's current account deficit. During this same period, though, two other measurements failed to maintain their long-assumed causal connections. For example, as the federal budget deficit metamorphosed into a surplus for 1998 to 2000, the current account deficit kept getting worse. That should not have happened. The decline of the U.S. dollar from 2002 to 2004 likewise failed as an antidote. The current account deficit widened further during that time period. The disarray in the nation's current accounts did not preoccupy George W. Bush when he became president, and the events of September 11th soon provided a compelling distraction. By 2004, however, the gravity of the deteriorating U.S. international balances could hardly be avoided. The world's number one debtor had also become its biggest borrower, in itself unprecedented, and dollar holders from Zurich to Beijing asked themselves what was likely to happen. The question was particularly important for the central banks of China, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. In the wake of the 2000 to 2001 stock market crash, private investors outside the United States had lost much of their interest in holding dollars, which added to the greenback's slow decline. However, beginning in a major way in 2002, Asian central banks stepped into the breach, buying U.S. Treasury debt on a grand scale, which worked to limit the dollar's erosion. The Congressional Budget Office, CBO, later calculated the purchase of U.S. assets by foreign governments at $113 billion in 2002, $280 billion in 2003, and $399 billion in 2004. Almost all of the purchases, said the CBO, came from Asia. In June 2004, the Financial Times reported a milestone. Demand for U.S. government bonds at foreign central banks has for the first time lifted overseas holdings to more than half the paper, Treasury debt, in circulation. As of that March, 50.6% of liquid Treasury bonds were in foreign hands, up from about 20% in 1995. The Atlanta Federal Reserve Bank in 2005 summed up that since 2001, Asian central banks' U.S. dollar reserves have increased by $1.2 trillion, roughly two-thirds of the cumulative U.S. current account deficit over that period. Two well-known international economists, Nouriel Roubini and Brad Setzer, have argued that the role of central banks in financing the U.S. budget deficit is much larger than some studies consider, since actual central bank purchases exceed recorded central bank purchases. Since 2000, all of the net new supply of treasuries has been purchased by non-residents, and about 80 to 90% of the new supply by foreign central banks. Politically, the implications were grave but enigmatic. The chugging of the U.S. economic locomotive, powered by the indebted American consumer, was really being financed by the central banks of the same countries selling John and Jane Smith their shoes, slacks, televisions, laptops, and Toyotas. The question was why, and answers were many. Officials of the Bush administration credited the ability of market forces to provide access to a globalized savings pool. However, cynics scoffed that because Asian central banks were losing money through purchasing short-term treasuries with negative real returns, their obvious motivation was to keep lucrative export markets open. Peter Marisi, a University of Maryland professor who earlier served as director of the Office of Economics of the U.S. International Trade Commission, went further, saying that China abuses global markets to obtain an objective: dominance. The importance of the American export market was real enough. Whereas U.S. manufacturing had been able to stage some recovery in the late 1980s with the help of a declining dollar, the underlying circumstances of 2004 to 2005 were much less yielding. More and more industries had been hollowed out by import penetration and by U.S. manufacturers' inability to compete with low-cost Asian production. By one calculation, foreign goods made up 38% of all durable goods purchases, including 54.5% of automobiles, 56% of computers and office equipment, 57% of semiconductors, 57% of all communications equipment, 71% of consumer electronics, 78% of apparel, and 99% of all footwear. Nor was this likely to change much. New investments in industries that manufactured tradable goods were ebbing in the United States because returns were better elsewhere. In 2004, U.S. investors and corporations got almost twice the return on their foreign direct investments, especially in Asia, that foreigners got on direct investments in the United States. The Dutch and British precedents were certainly relevant here. Imported petroleum, meanwhile, was riding a twin escalator. Its share of U.S. consumption was rising almost as fast as its cost per barrel. Economist Setzer, noting that outlays for oil imports had been some $100 billion in 2002, $130 billion in 2003, and $180 billion in 2004, predicted a 2005 oil import bill in the $232 billion range. Structural calcifications like these did not augur well for the U.S. current account deficit, which led serious economists back to the essential conundrum. What would happen to the dollar, and also to the willingness of Asian central banks to maintain and expand their dollar reserves to accommodate a further expansion of the U.S. current account deficit? Certain problems were already obvious. If interest rates in the United States rose to, say, 4-5% on 2-5-year Treasury notes, the federal government would face a considerably higher burden in servicing its huge debt, mostly short-term. Meanwhile, as Summers and others had noted, foreign central bank collaboration was not assured. I would suggest, the former Treasury Secretary had observed in 2004, that if one is seeking to draw lessons from the last 15 years of monetary experience, here is one that is very powerful. Fixed exchange rates with heavy intervention have enormous capacity to create an illusory sense of stability that could be shattered very quickly. That is the lesson of Britain in 1992, of Mexico in 1994, of emerging Asia in 1997, of Russia in 1998, and of Brazil in 1998. We can mark this down as a fourth danger zone of indebtedness. The national debt is the first, provided the reasonable additions that peg it in the $10 trillion to $15 trillion range. Household debt, deliberately ballooned by Washington policymakers, is the second. Financial sector indebtedness, the half-speculative nervous system that conjoins risky mortgages, shaky hedge funds, illiquid credit derivatives, and superbank overreach, is a third. The current account deficit belongs on the list, not least because of the unprecedented dimensions laid out by Summers and others. Not surprisingly, the previous leading world economic powers offer no precedent for the interplay of so many debt dimensions. I cannot help but think that the United States, like Spain in its day, has become something of a Judas economy for the average American, with Wall Street in the profitable bullion-handling role of early 17th century Seville, the Asian central banks as uncertain genuine financiers, and George W. Bush as the dull and prayerful Habsburg dynast. The caution about the United States using its global power to borrow, not to loan in the British manner, needs a bit more elaboration. Actually, the Kissinger deal with the Saudis and OPEC to recycle petrodollars in the 1970s and 1980s, discussed in Chapter 3, and the recent tacit arrangement with the East Asian central banks share a common design. Recycling by foreigners of U.S. payments for imports through channels that work to uphold the value of the U.S. currency. The possibility that both strings could soon run out as disillusionment with the United States sets in will be discussed in the concluding chapter. Not that any world currency winds down overnight. The Dutch guilder had a long process of being superseded by the British pound sterling, and some Britons understood by 1916 and 1917, never mind 1919, that the future might belong to the dollar. One historian has noted that the British Treasury warned the War Cabinet that by the end of 1916, the American executive and the American public will be in a financial position to dictate to this country. Several decades and two war-related global realignments later, that financial dependence was a fact. But before trying to add up the historical analogies, one more context requires pursuit. The likelihood of the United States being drawn into a war, terror-based, resource-based, or as some extension of the existing combats in Iraq and Afghanistan, akin to the expensive confrontations that helped to scuttle Spanish, Dutch, and British hegemony. War, the military and economic unmaking of global hegemons. If the god of Tim LaHaye and the Left Behind series turns out to be otherwise preoccupied, as he seems to have been during the later wartime embroilments of Spain, Holland, and Britain, then, lacking heavenly intervention, any major military confrontation in the Middle East or anywhere else could easily have results similar to those of the past. U.S. global supremacy could drain away more in 5 to 20 years than most Americans would have thought possible. In the months after September 11, 2001, Washington could have shaped a multilateral response able to maintain much of the worldwide goodwill volunteered to the United States in the wake of the shocking attacks. Instead, the administration's response was fundamentalist, unilateralist, and Manichaean, trumpeting a confrontation, briefly even termed a crusade, pitting good against evil. The invasion and occupation of Iraq, another poorly planned agenda, provided an environment that enabled overseas terrorism and radicalism to renew itself around a more acceptable anti-American cause. If terrorism remains center stage in a Middle Eastern war of attrition, that battle could last long enough, flaring into guerrilla wars and even civil wars, to wear the United States down militarily and economically. Osama bin Laden has hinted at exactly these hopes. Other outbreaks could be more conventional. The beginning deployment of the U.S. military as an oil defense force, bunched around oil production centers, the Middle East, the Caucasus, and West Africa, and also along pipeline routes and oil transportation sea lanes, crystallizes the possibility of periodic resource wars. For the United States, these would involve oil, but among other nations, water resources represent a second focus of contention. The Pentagon, as already noted, has prepared scenarios in which climate changes provoke resource wars. The annals of the leading world economic powers, however, show a clear pattern of major wars playing a central role in the upending of one hegemon and the emerging of another. Small conflicts can provide hints, but the great confrontations, the 30 Years' War, the wars of 1688 to 1713, the Seven Years' War, the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars, World War I and World War II, have been decisive catalysts. While the two 20th century world wars carry their global magnitude in their names, the others were forerunners. The 30 Years' War was a religious and political clash in Europe, but it had colonial and economic overtones elsewhere. Paul Kennedy notes that Dutch military expeditions struck at Brazil, Angola, and Ceylon, turning the conflict into what some historians describe as the First Global War. After peace came in 1648, the Dutch were the major beneficiaries, Spain the unhorsed leading power. The conflict of 1688 to 1713, precise historians divide it into two separate wars, marked Britain's emergence and relative Dutch weakening in trade, if not in global loan-making. Like the 30 Years' War, the conflicts of 1688 to 1713 reached around the world, and British gains at the peace table included Gibraltar, Minorca, Nova Scotia, and Newfoundland. The Seven Years' War and the Anglo-Dutch theater of the 1780 to 1784 global war that grew out of the American Revolution finished off Dutch pretensions and confirmed British predominance, a stature elevated by the Napoleonic Wars and confirmed at Waterloo. The 20th century wars, obviously, marked the two-stage undoing of British imperial and financial hegemony and the emergence of the United States in that role. But if war and its financial underpinnings are hallmarks of hegemonic rise and fall, a good case can be made for the simultaneous overlay of other forces, such as religion, natural resources, and culture, including so-called decadence. One common feature of Spanish, Dutch, and British commentaries during their respective heydays was attention to how the rhythms of the life cycles of nations resemble those of living organisms. Youth, maturity, old age, and passing. During the later part of these national spans, more weakens than simply the fiscal and economic underpinnings of empire. Probably that is why the great wars have been grim reapers of international hegemonies, as well as of so many individual lives. In addition to the various reformations and counter-reformations, maritime regimes, resource supremacies, and cultural rhythms, watershed changes in the intensity and cost of the major wars have also been decisive, as Paul Kennedy makes clear. The most important were far enough apart in time and in technological and economic demands that the cost of military success in the 17th century, for example, brought down a Spain that had been able to push Islam out of the Iberian Peninsula in the 15th century and usually control Italy in the transitional 16th. For Spain, suppressing the revolt in the economically and militarily determined and sophisticated Netherlands was a particularly crippling 80-year burden. "The war in the Netherlands," said one Spanish counselor, "has been the total ruin of this monarchy." The added effects of the 1618 to 1648 war were fatal. In Kennedy's words, depleted resources, bankruptcies, and smaller treasure fleets became a persistent drain. By scraping together fresh loans, imposing new taxes, and utilizing any windfall from the Americas, a major military effort could be supported. But the grinding costs of war always eroded these short-term gains, and within a few more years, the financial position was worse than ever. By the 1640s, in the aftermath of the Catalan and Portuguese revolts, and with the American treasure flow much reduced, a long, slow decline was inevitable. What other fate was due to a nation which, although providing formidable fighters, was directed by governments that consistently spent more than two or three times more than ordinary revenues provided? For the Dutch, military and financial depletion attended the late 17th and 18th century wars with France. Their exposed southern flank facing France required what for the Republic was a huge army, 119,000 at its peak between 1702 and 1713, and a costly chain of barrier forts. These outlays forced the Dutch to neglect their maritime and naval needs, and each of the French wars added more debt and also cost trade and foreign markets. Historian Jonathan Israel observes that, in terms of men and resources, the Republic mounted the largest and most sustained military and logistical effort in its history. Yet, despite the raising of expenditure and troop levels, it was clear the Republic was failing to keep pace with the growth of the armies and power of France, Britain, Prussia, and Austria. After peace came in 1713, military expenditure was reduced sharply. But the country's public debt remained at an unprecedentedly high level, more than 200% of GDP, while the provincial governments showed no inclination to increase taxation so as to be able to reduce the funded debt. While the War of 1672 to 78 had left Holland with a public debt of 38 million guilders, by 1713 this had risen to a staggering 128 million. A burden which had a paralyzing effect on the Republic's diplomacy and military establishment. This was part of the burden for having fought the War of the Spanish Succession principally on credit, avoiding large increases in taxation. Furthermore, the army cuts and continuing high levels of debt provoked new interprovincial tensions. The Netherlands remained neutral during the 1756 to 1763 war, pitting Britain and her allies against France and her allies. But Britain, quashing Dutch hopes, blocked neutrals from carrying cargoes into and out of France. Then the 1780 to 1784 fighting between Britain and the Netherlands completed the process, having terminal consequences for the Dutch old regime. It simultaneously bankrupted the treasury and provided the creditors of the government. In the Netherlands, not only the regents of Holland but countless humbler stockholders below them, with a much more aggressively insurrectionary language with which to verbalize their grievances. The ability of the Dutch elite to be lenders to the royal and princely houses of Europe while much of the country decayed was all but over. The British did take some of these lessons to heart. And when war broke out in 1914, their national debt was relatively small, certainly compared to its ratios in the 18th century and after 1815, and Britain's status as global creditor was impeccable. What no one expected, despite surprise at the expense of the Boer War, was the imminent new face of war in the 20th century. Technological intensity, all-out mobilization, and corresponding financial burdens. For the British people, 4 years of it produced massive disillusionment. For British financiers and treasury officials, the watershed was grim but hardly fatal. While in debt to the United States, Britain was otherwise still a global creditor, albeit to a much depleted extent. The Second World War completed the pauperizing process. Britain was stressed by the military budget demands of 1937 to 1939 rearmament, then bled further by the early stages of the war when the nation stood alone against Germany, paying by liquidating what was left of British overseas assets. Although a few historians quibble, the broad consensus was summed up in 2004 by The Economist. After two costly world wars and economic mismanagement, Britain became a net debtor, and the dollar usurped sterling's role. Dislodging an incumbent currency can take years. Sterling maintained a central international role for at least half a century after America's GDP overtook Britain's at the end of the 19th century. But it did eventually lose that status. Ferguson, the British historian, further distilled the lesson for the United States. It was a lot better, he said, to decline over 5 centuries than to telescope decline into a short period as Britain had done. The relevance to the United States today is unmistakable. In the 1980s, the national psychology ranged from mourning again in America to late-decade fear of Japan's rising sun. In 1991, concern over the U.S. budget deficit was such that Washington dunned its allies in the Gulf War to pay for the U.S. troops and their support, eliciting comments about latter-day Hessians. Then in 2004 and 2005, the initial ferocity of the national response to September 11th, in both Oval Office speeches and the invasion of bin Laden sheltering Afghanistan, gave way to military disarray in Iraq and fiscal disrepair at home. Indeed, the various fiscal deficits were joined by a serious political leadership deficit. By 2005, public opinion had turned against the earlier White House decision to invade and occupy Iraq, while support for withdrawal mounted. Ironically, shrinking budgets in London had haunted the earlier British occupation of Iraq in 1921 to 1922. The U.S. load in that country, however, was incomparably larger, as well as more provocative to global opinion. It was also helpful, even CIA officials admitted, to terrorist recruitment around the Islamic world. There is something about Iraq. Most cynics would nominate oil, but the influence of the Bible is also relevant, that clouds the competence of Anglo-American invaders and occupiers. If one relies on Spanish, Dutch, and British precedents, the international realignment that might cripple the United States and elevate Asia could be expected to come from a new bout of expensive global warfare. However, given that history doesn't repeat itself exactly, perhaps economically focused terrorism or a series of regional resource wars could satisfy the fates, even if a substantial portion of the Republican constituency does appear to be hoping for Armageddon and Christ's return. Social Security and Medicare. No debate has so focused on America's potential future indebtedness as that involving Social Security and Medicare, including the enormous projected costs of prescription drugs. To ensure the future of Social Security through 2080 or thereabouts, it is broadly agreed that something like $3.7 trillion must be injected into the system. Optimists, however, cite the Social Security Administration's own analysis that it will be able to pay all the promised benefits through 2042 and three-quarters of them thereafter. Medicare and the prescription drug program, in turn, are estimated to require another $30 trillion to be adequately funded for another 75 years. The idea of funding for a 75-year projection seems odd. The Pentagon has not guesstimated the burden of World War III, or 2.63 regional wars over the next half century, and the Energy Department has not weighed in on how to deal with annual oil import deficits likely to hit $500 billion per year by 2015. The Treasury has not projected the cost of a debt and credit implosion if one of those bubbles pops. One major skeptic of the crisis over Social Security, Merton Bernstein, staff director of the 1983 Social Security Commission, dismisses long-term projections as unreliable. Is there an economist or financial advisor who's going to tell you what's going to happen between right now and the end of the year? So why do we know that in 2042 the Social Security Trust Fund will have been used up? Part of the reason that Social Security has been such a priority for policymakers involves the near-term desire of elements of the financial services industry to privatize it, in whole or, more likely, in part. George W. Bush, who as governor of Texas had privatization targets that originally even included the University of Texas, spent political capital in 2005 on an unsuccessful proposal to partially replace Social Security with private accounts. By some calculations, the Treasury would have had to borrow some $2 trillion to implement the plan, and the system's long-term viability would not have been addressed. Privatization was the fundamental objective. The Social Security system, which presently enjoys an annual surplus of $150 billion per year, had already been enlisted in one finance-related recalculation. For many years, the system's surplus has been counted to reduce the actual federal budget deficit by that same amount. Thus, while the 2004 federal budget deficit was officially published at $412 billion, the true deficit was $567 billion, with the Social Security surplus being used as an offset. It is not quite fair to say that the effect of this bookkeeping has been to encourage higher deficits, but the blurring involved is definitely bond market friendly. If all of a sudden the U.S. budget deficit was admitted to be $150 billion higher, one can imagine the tenor of the meetings that would be convened by central banks in Tokyo, Beijing, Seoul, and Taipei. After all is said and done, of course, the private sector forces that have interests in Social Security privatization or its use in deficit camouflage also make a telling point. The resources needed to support the outlays presently projected could start falling short between 2018 and 2042. Liberals say that the problem could be avoided by ending the upper bracket-focused tax cuts enacted since 2001. Because these are projected to cost $11 trillion over 75 years, their elimination would more than pay for the $4 trillion Social Security needs over that period. If one can be computed, presumably the other can, but the inevitable political battle is not likely to produce that kind of simple choice. The ruckus over Medicare and the cost of prescription drug benefits is another story. With all the oil and debt problems on the horizon, the assumption that Medicare is going to unfold as planned over 75 years seems like a thought from cloud cuckoo land. Perhaps one-third of the Republican electorate is paying little attention because of religious preoccupations, while the leaders of American corporations in embattled legacy industries, such as airlines and automobile and parts manufacturers, are starting to favor a national health system as an enabler of their own survival. Depending on the severity of economic pressures, the 2010s could be the decade of decision. In the short run, though, Social Security and Medicare may continue as the issues that catalyze national discussions of deficits and debt. Somewhat longer term, the emerging debt and oil dangers could produce trouble in such a relatively proximate time frame, from just ahead through 2020 or 2025, that they are likely to control the parameters of the pension, old age, and medical coverage questions rather than vice versa. Planning for 2080 pales alongside the perils of failing to plan for the treacherous decade ahead. Absent a shift in Washington policy, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker was only the most prominent of many Americans to express worry recently about the vulnerability of the U.S. economy. David Walker, the Comptroller General of the United States, remarked that the greatest threat to our future is our fiscal irresponsibility, calling 2004 possibly the most fiscally reckless year in the history of the Republic. The other two dangers, oil dependency and radical religion, only made things worse. In August 2005, On the day that George W. Bush signed the much-touted energy bill that had finally passed Congress, global oil markets saluted its presumed unimportance by kicking the price of oil over $63 per barrel, a record. Moreover, 4 years of ineptness in dealing with the oil crisis was hardly the only weakness the Bush administration brought to global affairs. From Tokyo to Toronto, even old allies worried about the resiliency of a United States that could muddle so many critical national judgments while indulging a religious constituency hostile to science and significantly dedicated to extreme interpretations of the Book of Revelation. Unfortunately, the three perils fed on one another, and they also drew on a shared political base. Chapter 11. The Erring Republican Majority. There are disturbing trends, huge imbalances, disequilibria, risks, call them what you will. Altogether, the circumstances seem to be as dangerous and intractable as any I can remember. I don't know whether change will come with a bang or a whimper, whether sooner or later. But as things stand right now, it is more likely than not it will be financial crises rather than policy foresight that will force the change. Paul Volcker, former Federal Reserve Chairman, The Washington Post, 2005. We're not only outsourcing manufacturing to China and services to India, but we've managed to outsource our financing to Asia. Stephen Roach, Chief Economist, Morgan Stanley, 2004. As far as I know, there is not a single contingency plan in place or currently being written by any of the think tanks of the world that sets out a model illustrating how the world can continue to function smoothly once it is clear that Saudi Arabian oil has peaked. In a nutshell, it is this total lack of any alternative scenario thinking that makes this unavoidable event so alarming. Matthew Simmons, Twilight in the Desert, 2005. If religious extremism is only one large set of bodies in this fringe constellation of Republican interest groups, it is a powerful one. That is why federal agencies reject scientific reports on ecological, stem cell, contraceptive, and abortion issues. They sponsor not only faith-based social relief, but faith-based war, faith-based science, faith-based education, and faith-based medicine. Gary Wills, The New York Review of Books, 2005. No explanation of the theme of this book, U.S. oil vulnerability, excessive indebtedness, and indulgence of radical religion, can ignore the encouragement of the Republican Party and its electoral coalition, especially since 2000. Policy excesses and blind constituency commitments have a long history of developing around a stagnant but entrenched politics that has overstayed its national usefulness. This, alas, is an established pattern in the United States, with its long cycles of party domination in Washington. It does not really matter which of the three is primary at any given moment. Some crisis may suddenly resolve the question, or appear to. A war, a popping financial bubble, a religious event, another major terrorist attack, $5 gasoline. History, however, tends to interrelate events, and threats that necessarily have been discussed separately in this book show further signs of integration. Oil and the debt and credit crunch, true-believing religion and the substitution of faith for science and national strategy. The Republican Electoral Coalition, near and dear to me 4 decades ago when I began writing The Emerging Republican Majority, has become more and more like the exhausted, erring majorities of earlier failures. The militant, southernized Democrats of the 1850s, the stock market-dazzled and Elmer Gantry-ish GOP of the 1920s, and the imperial liberals of the 1960s with their great society social engineering, quagmire in Vietnam, and new economy skills expected to tame the business cycle. Now the Republicans are again the miscreants. In some ways, the emerging Republican majority is becoming the emerging Republican theocracy, although that might still be kept from fuller fruition. More broadly, suffice it to say that the nation's most troublesome circumstances owe much to the fealty of an erring Republican majority to its most important constituencies. The inadequacy of the Democrats. Every 4 years, they seem to resemble the not-ready-for-primetime players who made Saturday Night Live a byword 3 decades ago. Complicates things, but hardly excuses what the Republican Party has become. A vehicle of special interests that have become entrenched in crippling commitments and biases. What we must now look at is the interplay of these constituencies and favoritisms with wrong-headed decision-making. After Iraq, oil, debt, and the dollar. The interrelationship of oil and the U.S. dollar, while increasingly strained, does hark back many years. If the Allies floated to World War I victory on a sea of American oil, as one European statesman observed, the dollar shared in that new buoyancy, becoming a potential replacement for sterling as the world's leading currency. World War II, another oil-facilitated victory, led to American hegemony, making the dollar the world's reserve currency. When a new global oil regime emerged from the Middle East upheaval between 1973 and 1981, Washington took pains to assure that black gold still worked to maintain the supremacy of the dollar. Through the good offices of Saudi Arabia, OPEC agreed to price oil in dollars, which meant that a Belgian or Peruvian had to obtain greenbacks to purchase it. Also to the point, the oil-producing nations, especially the Persian Gulf states under U.S. influence, usually deposited much of the oil payment they received, the appropriately named petrodollars, in U.S. banks. Not a few wound up being invested in U.S. Treasury debt. In consequence, the migration of oil production leadership away from North America, so vivid by the 1980s and 1990s, did not dethrone the dollar, which still enjoyed a critical link to petroleum. In the meantime, the United States began spending money like a drunken sailor, also indulging its inheritance of the sort of finance that has nursed the lion's share of global manias, panics, and crashes. By the 1990s, as we have seen, financial services, led by the growth of debt, became the ascendant sector in the U.S. economy. Thereafter, finance fattened during the early 2000s, this notwithstanding the 2000 to 2002 collapse of the stock market bubble, on a feast of low-interest enablement, credit card varietals, exotic mortgages, derivatives, hedge fund strategies, and structured debt instruments that would have left 1920s scheme meister Charles Ponzi in awe. By mid-decade, however, the reports of ever higher American debt had been augmented by estimates of ever lower U.S. oil production. The latter fed the former. Experts pondered whether, as 2010 approached, the cost of U.S. oil and petroleum product imports, potentially 6 to 8 billion barrels a year at $50 to $70 per barrel or worse, could approach $400 billion per year. Such an outflow could well uncouple the U.S. dollar from its last oil prop. Petroleum producers would no longer want to be paid in dollars, conceivably preferring euros, a new Asian currency, or a basket of currencies. As economists mulled over the predictions by Paul Volcker and others, many such scenarios were posed. The failure of the U.S. invasion of Iraq with respect to oil supplies became one of the great underreported stories of the decade. Far from achieving the covert aims discussed in Chapter 3, flooding the world with cheap Iraqi production, breaking the back of OPEC, installing ExxonMobil in the rich Majnoon fields, and living happily ever after on $20 to $30 oil for America's SUVs and McMansions, the outcome was disastrous. Iraqi oil production shrank in the face of sabotage and relentless insurgent attacks on the major pipelines. OPEC survived, and oil prices soared. The havoc wreaked by Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf of Mexico oil facilities in 2005 heightened the U.S. predicament, but the critical failure came in Washington's flawed calculations in the Middle East. The dollar, already declining before the invasion, sank further in 2003 to 2004 as a number of OPEC nations moved to reduce their dollar holdings, while investing in their own rising stock markets and real estate. Whereas in 2002 the United States had paid $100 billion for its imported oil needs, that rose to over $230 billion in 2005, with expectations of considerably worse to come. No U.S. military commitment, perhaps not even in Vietnam, so utterly failed in its unspoken objectives. Financial dominoes shook or toppled, from the price of oil on the New York Mercantile Exchange to OPEC's ebbing commitment to the dollar. Should the dollar's decline persist, the world's reasonable perception, or so many economists argued, would be that the United States was attempting to depreciate and inflate its way out of its huge debts. Foreign central banks, in Asia first and foremost, but also elsewhere, would be unwilling to buy or hold large quantities of U.S. Treasury debt in their reserves. Such disillusionment would further depress the greenback, making the cost of oil, by that point no longer priced in dollars, continue to rise for Americans. Of course, a sharp downturn in the U.S. economy. Hypotheses included a sudden surge in interest rates, a stock market slide, a speculative debacle, a house price implosion, a recession, or some unnerving combination, would curb U.S. demand for manufactured imports and oil, reducing those pressures. That kind of slump, however, would pose other dangers. A spreading assets deflation, trade protectionism, different reasons for foreign banks to unload their dollars, and so forth. The internet chat room conversations of global economists, cloaked in anonymity, tended toward pessimism. In this economic world turned upside down, others hinted at the problem the United States might face in paying higher interest on mounting national debt. Amid 2002 to 2004 interest rates low enough to be negative after adjustment for inflation, the Treasury had refinanced so as to make most of its debt under 5 years in duration and cheap to carry. As a result, whereas Washington in 1997 had paid $356 billion worth of interest on $5.4 trillion worth of debt, by 2003, with rates at rock bottom, $318 billion sufficed to cover the interest on $6.8 trillion. However, should short-term rates reach the 4.5 to 5.5% range, almost double those of 2003, the interest payable on $8 trillion to $9 trillion of debt could rise to $400 to $500 billion, a major strain on the year-to-year U.S. budget. The Republicans in control of Congress and the White House, meanwhile, conducted both fiscal and energy policy in a state of denial. Denial, at least, of any potential crisis. The Bush administration energy legislation enacted in 2005 left the global energy markets sufficiently unimpressed that oil prices made new highs. Skeptics observed that the most important sections of the bill were those deleted at various stages, meaningful provisions requiring the government to find ways of reducing U.S. oil demand, automakers to improve fuel efficiency, and utilities to generate 10% of electricity from renewable energy sources. Powerful constituencies found such strictures unacceptable, although the federal government had raised the standards of energy efficiency for refrigerators, for example, 6 times since the 1970s, with enough success that comparable new units use only 1/4 as much electricity. Any remotely similar gain in automobile and truck efficiency would go a long way to ease oil import demands. Conservatives in the White House and Congress also continued to insist on making the 2001 to 2003 tax cuts permanent, despite unimpressive cost-benefit analyses. Over 75 years, as noted earlier, these changes were projected to cost $11 trillion, dwarfing the $4 trillion price tag of fully funding Social Security benefits. Furthermore, the tax reductions were skewed toward the upper income brackets in ways that lessened their stimulative effects. The lowered rates on capital gains and dividends, for example, were calculated to produce only 9 cents of stimulus for every dollar of foregone revenue, and the reduction of overall rates only 59 cents on a dollar. By contrast, the small amount of federal aid to state governments in the Bush package was rated at a more effective $1.24 of stimulus for every dollar. If U.S. excesses of debt and energy consumption remained on giddy and converging trajectories, the reactions overseas were wary. Among the oil producers, as we saw in Chapter 3, Iran, Indonesia, Malaysia, Venezuela, and others had moved earlier to reduce their use of dollars or to take other measures against U.S. financial domination of the oil markets. In 2005, Russia, Singapore, and Malaysia all announced small but significant shifts in their central bank reserves from dollars to euros. Even rumors or careless comments about possible currency diversification in the East Asian nations, which had made huge purchases of U.S. Treasury bills and notes, at least $399 billion in 2004, if not as much in 2005, produced moments of panic in the U.S. financial markets. One such episode in South Korea was described as follows. As the Korean comment ping-ponged around the world, all hell broke loose, with currency traders selling dollars for fear that the central banks of Japan and China, which hold immense dollar reserves, might follow suit. That would be the United States' worst economic nightmare. Economists in the United States worked up models and estimated the impact of various Chinese central bank actions, ranging from significant sales of the dollar to simply halving China's purchases of U.S. Treasury debt. The U.S. economy could be hurt by interest rates on bonds that were between 0.4% and 2 full percentage points higher than they otherwise would have been. As in so many critical arenas, the U.S. government had no clear strategy, save for allowing the dollar to weaken in 2003 to 2004 while professing to uphold its strength. In both oil consumption and currency management, the clock of American vulnerability was ticking. Religion and the Republican Coalition. As commentators on oil and debt pondered leaden-gray skies, the 30% to 40% of the Republican Coalition that read the Left Behind series or believed in the rapture were looking toward the heavens more hopefully. Fundamentalist preachers, Sunday gospel hours, and end times websites monitored the countdown, analogizing events to biblical predictions and speculating about advancing time horizons. In 2005, 42% of Americans described themselves to survey takers as born again, only slightly below the readings of 2001 and 2002. George W. Bush reassured the faithful that summer and autumn by endorsing the teaching of intelligent design, implicit godly design to be sure, alongside evolution in U.S. schools, and by choosing nominees who were conservative on the abortion issue to fill two U.S. Supreme Court vacancies. Because the retiring Sandra Day O'Connor had been a swing vote in earlier high court rulings, her replacement was expected to be decisive. The president also reassured the faithful by renewing his promise to veto any legislation to liberalize stem cell research, its lopsided public support notwithstanding. The peril to Republicans lay in growing voter skepticism about the influence on national policy wielded by the religious right and the wisdom of mixing religion and politics. In 2002 and 2003, the average American had favored more religiosity in public officials rather than less, results that encouraged Bush in his open religiosity and biblical phraseology. However, the polls had begun to change in 2004 and soured further in 2005, with twice as many respondents saying the Christian right had too much influence in Washington as said it had too little. The 2004 presidential election campaign had raised questions about Bush's religious intensity, including a perception that he saw himself speaking for God. Then the Schiavo dispute provoked particular national disillusionment and belief that the president and Congress were pandering to the religious right. Voters were also displeased by White House attempts to build friendly churches into a political machine, opposing that kind of involvement by more than 2-to-1 in public opinion polls. With George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney both retiring in 2008, jockeying by would-be presidential candidates began quickly within the Republican Party. Among those getting early attention were Senate Republican leader Bill Frist of Tennessee, Senator John McCain of Arizona, and former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Florida Governor Jeb Bush, in turn, was watched carefully for any sign of a Bush family effort to prolong its White House dynasty. Because the religious right had so much power within the party, few observers thought that McCain could prevail at a national party convention, even if he had done well in the primaries. The Arizona senator's age, he would be 72 in 2008, and his uncertain health were also drawbacks.